Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of the Dunker Spot. We are part of the Basketball News Podcast Network. I am your host, Nikaius Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. How are you, sir?
Doing well, doing great. Never fear, Steve is here. I'm just happy and thankful to be associated with this podcast and the great and wonderful mind of Nikaius Duncan.
All right.
Let's have some fun tonight, guys. Big Urban Meyer energy from your boy.
Absolutely not. There will be no remnants of Urban Meyer on this here podcast. Would I have any of that? Glad to have you with me. I am ready to rock this out, talk about some basketball as long as we can, because the COVID cases are flying. A bit unfortunate. Honestly, I'm tired of talking about COVID on this podcast, man. I just want things to get better. And however that can happen, that's what I'm rooting for at this point. Let's talk.
Works for me.
There we go. I guess while we're on a negative note, let's talk about Zion Williamson, who has yet to play a game this season. We've been waiting on the foot recovery. Apparently is not going well. He received an injection to promote bone healing in his right foot. He's going to be reevaluated in 4 to 6 weeks. From what I read, he hadn't even progressed to before this happened, before he had the recent setback. I think he was only up to playing 3-on-3 and hadn't gotten to full 5-on-5 yet. So this kind of setback, do you think he's going to play this year?
I already told you he's not playing this year. Zion Williamson is not playing this year. It's not happening. It's a wrap. It's an unfortunate wrap, but Zion's not playing this year. There's no reason for him to play this year. Team is in a position for him to have the impact you'd want him to have. There's no need to rush him back. He's done for the season, in my opinion.
Right. It's certainly trending towards that way, at least. I would imagine the Pelicans will want to get him at least a few games just to see how he meshes with the new talent, or at least just give him some momentum heading into the offseason, which, man, that's going to be an interesting offseason. Because if Zion doesn't play, I mean, we're looking at what? I mean, less than 100 career games at this point, heading into an offseason in which he becomes extension eligible, on top of the smoke that's already been out there surrounding him, or at least his camp not being super happy, front office turmoil. It's going to be an interesting scenario to track in New Orleans, to say the least. But before even getting into all that, I just want Zion to be okay. He's an incredibly talented basketball player, incredibly fun to watch when he's actually on the court. So hopefully whatever this is that's happening with his foot, hopefully it's resolved and this is the last of it. And so we can finally get to see Zion unleashed. I think that's what the people want to see.
Yeah, jokes aside, I want them to get it right, especially when he is that athletic with that size and power and it's a foot deal. I want him to take his time, get it right, and we'll see him when he's back. We know what he can do to a degree. Would have loved to see him take another leap this year, but I don't know if we're seeing it.
Get well soon, Zion. We need to see it. We need to see it. On a more positive note, Isaiah Thomas is back in the league. Signed a 10-day contract with the Los Angeles Lakers. The Lakers are going to need some scoring help because Russell Westbrook is yet another player that has entered into COVID, the health and safety protocols. But shout out to Isaiah Thomas for getting a shot. Just dropped 42 points in the G League showcase last night. I guess Lakers brass saw the films. Hey, we could use that kind of scoring punch off the bench. How you feel about it?
I love it. IT has been on a road, and I am glad to see him back in the league. And again, I'm just hoping he's able to land. That the career he's had, the moments he's had, the productions he's had, for it to go the way it did, I would like him to have a happier ending, or at least the opportunity to write his own ending in a way that career deserves, which it's sports, so you don't always get that, but it's just good to see him back. I'll put it that way. It is good to see him back. I was hyped when he dropped the 42. Then I was hyped when I saw that he got added. And then immediately it was like all the Laker guards are in protocols. But should be fun.
It should be fun indeed. Like,
now, I have a question for you on IT.
Okay.
But I'll let you go.
I don't have anything else to add right now. What do you have?
I believe you made a comment about this signing. I was just looking for further clarification as to what you meant. About the IT thing going a certain way. I'm just curious.
Because I just... One, I just don't want this to turn into like Melo 2.0, in which we pretend that we didn't see what we saw the last time we saw said player. It's going to turn into this entire referendum on like it. I want this to be a feel-good story for Isaiah Thomas and just a feel-good story for Isaiah Thomas. I think that's the best way for me to phrase it.
Well, part of the feel good is addressing those who wrote him off.
Yes, but I think it's also fair to acknowledge like why he was quote unquote written off, and to make sure that we
injuries.
Yes, and like you know, it's okay to point out that on top of the injuries obviously hurt him. But also the margins weren't very large for Isaiah Thomas to begin with because of the size, because of the defensive limitations. So once you have the hip injury and that kind of limits what he could do at the rim, then it kind of turns into pull-up shooting and some playmaking or bust for him. And so that's part of the reason why he hasn't been able to stick as of late. So for everyone's sake, like I do hope that he has a successful stint with the Lakers.
We have seen this conversation with Melo, DeMarcus Cousins, Blake Griffin, Derrick Rose. And so it's not going away, pal. Go ahead and buckle up. Let IT drop 20.
It's gonna happen.
Your mentions are going to get torn up.
Not my mentions. I won't see them. Shout out to the quality filter. We are not... We're not about to have any of that. Let's dig into a mailbag. We crowdsourced some questions from our dear listeners, the dunkers out there. So thank you for sending those in. And as always, if you have questions for us, you do not need a mailbag prompt. If you're watching, if you listen to a pod, if you're watching the game, you're just bored after class, after work or something, you have some questions you want to shoot our way, email us at dunkerspot@yahoo.com. We will get to them when we have mailbag episodes such as this one. And with that, we can kick this off with Nathan. He says, my questions are on defensive improvement and are probably a little more for Steve. How would you explain Denny Avdia's improvement to becoming the Israeli Kirilenko after being mediocre to bad defensively just last year? What kind of exercises, focuses, et cetera, go into that kind of growth? And a related question, do you guys think it's easier to improve defensively as a superlative athlete with all the tools but limited awareness of processing, or as a limited athlete with excellent awareness and processing?
Well, it depends on which version of Kirilenko he's talking about. But jokes aside, I think one thing for him is he's gotten more comfortable. I think some of the rules physicality wise has helped him as far as being able to be more physical off ball, which is putting him in better positions on ball. I think he's been switching a lot better, and being able to guard multiple positions in multiple different areas helps him pop a little bit more, you know, because if he can start a possession guarding like a Cam Johnson or a shooter and then switch onto the big, switch to pick and roll, and now he's all over the place and kind of a base for that defense. So I think that's helped him just to widen it out a little bit. I think sometimes for players, I think the personnel around you helps you look better. I think better coaching and focus and schemes also can help you look better. So like there's a little bit of a natural progression for players. I mean, because coming in the league, there's an adjustment, like the game, the speed, the pace, the shooting, the play calls, the communication. So you see kind of his growth and his understanding and the reps paying off, because he had to take those lumps last year. And most young players have to take those lumps. It's hard to grow defensively if you don't know what doesn't work. And that's part of why, to me, playing time is so important for these young guys, to have those moments where you, things either start clicking or you understand, okay, I can't afford to do that. And night in, night out, now you have different game plans. You got different guys you're trying to guard. Maybe you're guarding a non-shooter one night, so you got a different responsibility. Maybe you're guarding a wing scorer, so now you're on ball in all the actions, and having to kind of gauge going back and forth on that. So as far as exercises, focuses to go into the growth, I mean, the number one obvious thing is probably practice, to help you know when you can help, how far you can help. But obviously, I think it's game plan discipline helps you. Knowing the personnel helps you. Understanding and studying your opponent to know what they want to do and being able to take that away and become bothersome that way, that can give you an edge. But just, it's the learning process, you know, learning what you're supposed to do defensively. What is the outcome supposed to be? What's the why behind what we're doing? You know, if they say switch everything, what's that really mean? When are we switching? When are we not switching? When are we helping after the switch? You know, if my big is on Chris Paul, am I at the elbow? Where's my help coming from? So it's again, it's reps, film, going over the game plan and continuing to learn. And then the second question, did you have an answer for that one? Because I got one.
Like, this is kind of tore me a little bit, because I generally lean towards the latter. Like, I think if you already see the floor quickly enough, I mean, if you process things quickly enough and you have an understanding of angles and space, then I think you can handle a multitude of matchups or a multitude of assignments. Almost, obviously, there are limitations. You know, if you don't have vertical pop as a big, like, there's only so much you can do in drop, for example. Or if you don't have elite foot speed, there are only so many matchups you can take on ball. But, like, I think I want the processing, because I worry less about the mistakes on that front. And I think defense is so team-oriented anyway. I would rather have the guy that, one, doesn't put himself out of position, but also can recognize when other cracks are happening, can rotate and clean up messes in that way, versus the elite tools guy who make him recover, but is putting your defense in a bind anyway if he's out of position.
Well, let's explore what you said, because that team guy, awareness guy, can also put you in just as much of a bind as the athletic, I guess, airhead, to say. Because if you're the guy that's constantly getting beat off the dribble, you become a weak link as well, right?
Yeah, that's fair.
So it's an interesting question, because there are benefits to both and there are limitations to both. And the key for either is to grow and get out of the liability zone. So to your point, you don't want to be the weak link. And so you are going to have your warts, but how well can you hide them? Because with the athlete who lacks that awareness, they have the athleticism to make up for it. So if you help too late, you can get back out and recover and close out. Now, is that happening every single time? So if that's happening every single time, then now it's just an issue. Like, how are we continuing to do this? But you get beat off the dribble, you can recover, contest, and you get lost off the screen, you can get back in position. There's things you can do. With the other side, how much of it has to do with the personnel around you would be the question I would ask. Let's take Josh Giddey, for example, right?
Mm-hmm.
He probably looks like a really, really, really good fit, or a much more solid defender around an elite group of defenders, right?
Mm-hmm.
At least another great wing or a great big who can clean up mistakes. But if you put him on a different team, or maybe he has to guard different players, or there's not much help behind it, or the help defense is bad, you can't afford that. So there's a personnel element in here that makes it fun and interesting, because that's the player you usually trust because, you know, hey, I know they're going to execute the scheme. I know they're going to be in the right position. I know we're going to be okay. At worst, they're going to get beat off the dribble, and our defense is designed to help versus that. But at the same time, those are the players that the stars go after, right? Hey, you, come here. Your man comes to the screen, mm-hmm. and you got to deal with me. And now you guys got to come help all the time. So it's kind of a pick your poison type deal. So for me, as far as which one is easier to improve, I would say there's a higher ceiling for the athlete, but a higher floor for the person with awareness and processing. And it's probably easier for the person with the awareness to improve because there's only so much more they can do, if that makes sense. They're not going to become a super athlete.
Yeah.
But hey, I can short close on this guy, or I can make sure I'm not over helping so I can get back to this guy. And okay, if I get beat, maybe I'll late switch and go back to someone else. You know, those kind of little things. The athlete, if they figure it out, like let's just use Nick Claxton, for example, part of what helped him pop was his ability to recover, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like he switched, he stays in front, he gets beat, he's able to still contest. Now, as he improves, he's not getting beat as much. Now it's tougher.
Mm-hmm.
So now you have a whole different monster. So for me, I think it's higher ceiling for the athlete, but easier for the other one to improve. That'd be my final answer.
I feel that. Boo nuance. But no, like do you weigh that differently depending on the position? Like if you're looking for if you're looking at wings, would you prefer to have the athlete versus the quick processor that's a limited athlete? Or, you know, as a big man, would you prefer to have the processor versus like where do you go with that? Or how does the position factor in?
It's a good question. They all have their pluses and minuses. As far as point guards go, I'll take the awareness over the athleticism. You're likely going to be in pick and roll a lot, so you need to be able to navigate and be smart on that end. So I'll take that. As far as the wing goes, I probably lean a little bit more towards athleticism just to avoid having to deal with the constant post-ups and ISOs. And now, you know, my defense is trying to help me out all the time. Biggs is an interesting one because we've seen both of them have success. That's a tough one for me. Big, I'm going with the awareness and processing. I just thought of Marc Gasol. I think he could defend pick and rolls until he's done. That's just me.
Yeah.
But I'll take that positioning, even with the limitations that go with it, over the athlete who may not be in the right spot at the right time. You know, it's great that you can contest at the rim, but if you're constantly letting people come to the rim, we have an issue.
Okay.
It's a fun question, Nathan. Sorry, go ahead, Nakias.
No, it's a very good question. Like I'm with you. Like I would want the high processing, high awareness guy. Like I think on the wings and I think just backline in general, like I would want the processor and maybe I'd have the athlete at the point of attack. Because I think of someone like, and I mean, he's gotten better at it this year, but like I think of someone like Matisse Thybulle, who is an absurd athlete and is good at the point of attack, but like he can sometimes get washed out on the screen or he might take a bad angle on the screen, but because he's so reactive, he can kind of make up for that. And I think if you have someone like that at the point of attack and you have smart rotators, you have guys that can, you know, close gaps behind that, then I think that sets you up to be an ironclad defense. Like I'm with you. Like Marc Gasol is a great person to bring up as far as the front line. Like maybe him versus, let's say like the first couple of years of like Miles Turner, for example, who could swat shots, but could also find himself out of position pretty easily just because he was so eager And again, he's someone that's gotten better at that over the years as well. So like he sees the floor a lot better in that regard than he did early in his career. But like that's the kind of bind that someone like that can put, he can put that kind of bind on your defense.
You bring up an interesting point. I'm curious, now that we're just rolling on this, as much as we talk about which one's easier to improve, if you're the athlete, you do need to get the awareness because the athleticism can bring you to the dance, get you the bag, but eventually it's going to fade. So I hate to bring up this example, but you think about someone like DeAndre Jordan, he upped his awareness to a certain level, and that helped him stick around. And now, for me, if you never have the awareness, it's tough either way. But if you have the awareness, you give yourself a shot, which makes it interesting. I got an example. Scottie Barnes, which category would you put him in?
Scottie's fun for me.
Extremely. That's why I brought him up. Yeah, I watched him guard KD. And we've talked about him this season. I wondered which bucket would you put him in?
I feel like on the defensive end, I feel like he's more of the superlative athlete than the processor right now. I feel like the processing shines through for him offensively more than defensively right now, which is natural for young players. But there has been some off-ball stuff with him that has shown up in film. One, he's young, but also the Raptors, I mean, they require you to help quite a bit. You got to make a lot of split decisions in space because of how aggressively they defend. So it's easy to get lost in that kind of sauce. So it's not something that I'm worried about. But I think right now he's more a superlative athlete than the quick processor right now. He's still trying to figure some stuff out. The young player I was thinking about in this was Anthony Edwards, who is an insane athlete. But you know, he's made strides this year, particularly off the ball. Like, he's been more solid as like a guy that shows help at the nail or can pre-rotate and be in the right spots, but he's still trying to navigate multiple actions. Like, he still very much has some of those year one lapses too. So I think he's an interesting case study in something like this.
No, he is a good one, because at the end of the day, and that's what makes it interesting, because all you needed to do is for him to be solid. If he could just be solid, now your defense looks better. You know, if you get those kind of athletes or those kind of scorers to just be okay and execute A, B, and C, you give yourself a better chance than if they're liabilities. So, I mean, it's a fascinating question, because then you get into the trade-off where, hey, this person's scoring a bunch. I think I'm okay with whatever they do on that end for the majority of the time. Eventually, they'll find the effort. And then how much of it is going to be effort, you know, because you can have all the athleticism and awareness in the world, but if you're not giving it up, you put yourself in a bind. This is a fun question. I could probably do this question all day.
There we go. That's how we kick things off. This is a great job. Let's make you mad very quickly. This one comes from Jim, who says, what's going on with the Hawks in fourth quarters this year? I know Steve defends the all bench second units. Why does it not seem to work for the Hawks? It's not like they don't have good players even with the injuries. It didn't work when we were healthy either. Is it harder to have a second unit with a heliocentric player like Trey? What types of players would make an ideal second unit?
Ah, bringing the heat. I like it. Good question, Jim. Thanks for it. Now, the one interesting point to me, and I pointed out to you and Mr. AVO, wherever he is, haven't seen him in a while. When they played Houston, I believe they started with John Collins out there to start the fourth, with Cam Reddish, Lou Will, Gorgie, and DeLon Wright. And they quickly went to Capella for Gorgie Dieng for reasons. And then I believe against Orlando, they had Capella out there to start the fourth. So I'll Euro step past the all bench second unit for a second and just talk about the Hawks, because I think they have an interesting dynamic right now with that start of fourth quarter or second unit lineup, in the sense that I'm not sure they know what they are, and I'm not sure if they know how to get to it. So for me, when it comes to that second unit, you need execution, you need discipline. But for Atlanta, who's your pressure point? And like, this is where offensively having a lot of Trae Young is great, but now what's the second unit run? What are they going to do? You can't necessarily run the same exact sets. You don't have the same pressure points. Now you have movement. But if I'm a team, why wouldn't I just switch all of you that are out here and keep the ball in front? And now I don't have to help. I don't have to rotate. You're not getting the same reads. And while you have the talent in Lou Will and Danilo and Cam Reddish, they're having to do a lot of creating on their own. And they all can score very well, but how many of them are driving and forcing help?
Yeah, it's a problem.
So now you're hoping you get some handoffs going, but there's got to be purpose and flow with it. And now if you start to stagger, say you bring a Collins in with that unit, how are you using him? Is he now the pressure point? Is he the focus? Is he the scorer? Or is he the person that's supposed to open things up? You say the same thing if you do it with Capella. So it's just that for me, with them, it feels like just that lack of offensive consistency and that lack of having something for them. Because you can get Lou Will going and pick and roll, and you'll have nights where it works. Cam can get it going. You can do Danilo in the post. He can do his old man game. But it's a lot of them having to create their own buckets, and it doesn't feel like they're getting a lot of pressure on the defense. So if I were to contrast them with other second units around the league, it just doesn't feel like they have the same threat right now. That's what I would say.
I'm with you there. Just to throw some numbers on it very quickly, just looking at what these lineups do in the fourth quarter, the Lou Williams, DeLon Wright, Cam Reddish, Gallo, and Clint Capella lineup has a negative 10.7 net rating. It is Atlanta's third most used fourth quarter lineup right now. And if you swap out Capella for John Collins, it is a minus 21.7 net rating. And the offenses for both lineups are very, very bad.
So, all of you staggerers out there, take that for data.
Yes, I do think I'm not a fan of having John and Trey off the court at the same time. Like, I'll stick with that. But to your point, like, there seems to be a real lack of rim pressure without Trey on the court. And so even if you're using John Collins as a pressure point, Clint Capella as a pressure point, both of those guys are really good vertical spacers. Like, if you don't have anyone that's threatening the rim to free them up, or threatening enough as a pull-up shooter to force defenders out and kind of open up those roles more, then it's like, what does that really mean? Because, like, even the Gallo old man game, like you talked about in the last pod, like, it's probably a couple of dribbles and a pull-up. Like, he's not pressuring the rim. It kind of stinks that Gallo has, you know, gotten older, has dealt with injuries, because like in his prime, or even later in his prime, like he was always a sneaky high free throw rate guy. And he's not that anymore. Lou Williams can get into the dark magic bag some, but like he just doesn't pressure the rim in the same way. It's just different for him. And so like I wonder at what point more of the like second unit usage goes to Cam, because I think he's someone that can get downhill, but even that's going to depend on like what he can do when he gets there, because he hasn't, you know, he's been a good finisher in spurts, but overall, like, he hasn't been a great finisher since he's been in the league. So I wonder if he could draw enough defensive attention to really make that work. But that might be the counter that Atlanta tries to develop throughout the regular season.
I wonder if some of this is maybe they should let DeLon Wright have the ball a little bit more with the second unit. I mean, we've seen what he can do. He's produced and done it in different places. If you think back to Dallas, he would ideally be the person who could start the pick and roll, make the read, and now those guys can be finishers or playmakers as the defense rotates, as opposed to Lou Will coming off. All due respect, he's a great talent, but you know what it's going to be. And with Cam Reddish, even if you go to handoffs for him, you don't know when it's going to be a pull-up, when it's going to be two hard dribbles and a yank back. And it's like, wait a minute, keep going. You had something there. So it's just that kind of deal. And it's a tough part because it's really where they could make it work. You just kind of have to tweak it. So if you're going to use Collins, use the empty corner stuff. Make the defense make a decision that way. Use Gallinari as a spacer. Like, there's ways to get it done, but it just feels like they're kind of mixed and in between on, okay, we're running this. It didn't work. Now what are we flowing into? And if more teams start to switch, it becomes more difficult. So I just like for them to up the pace, up the tempo, and, you know, not necessarily have it be a DeLon Wright, Danilo post-up type deal, you know? No, I mean, I like it mixed in, but when that's just like the base, it's like, okay, well, why is John Collins out here? You could have ran this without him. Why is Clint Capella out here? You could have ran this without him.
No, that makes sense. Like, it's a lot of East-West with the second unit right now. And so it would be nice if they had someone that could stir the drink in a way. Like, maybe that is more DeLon.
Well, I mean, plus you wonder how much not having Hunter hurts, because you could have hurt her with that, and now it's a different, maybe it's a different equation. You never know. And then as far as the next part of it, I feel like the fourth quarters for Atlanta is just very Trey dependent, like extremely Trey Young and pick and roll dependent. And we've seen when it's on fire, it's on fire. There's not much defenses can do. When he's hitting shots, hitting floaters, getting lobs, kicking out, you're at his mercy. But you're going to have the nights where he drives, doesn't finish, or you defend the lob well, and now it's a turnover, you score a couple buckets on the other end, now it's tight, they go to it again, maybe don't score, you know what I mean? But it's kind of Trey or bust. So it's interesting there. As far as the harder to have a second unit with a heliocentric, what heliocentric mean? That means... He's the center, right?
Yeah, just very Trey-centric. He's going to pound the ball, make all the decisions. Y'all play finish.
I don't think it's necessarily harder, but you do have to make sure you have a base. So that way you can have some version of offensive continuity. And if it's going to be the first unit runs a lot of Trey Young pick and roll, that's fine. You just need to make sure you have other sets in there. And the second unit runs the heck out of those sets. You know, the Spurs used to run a bunch of post-ups for Tim Duncan, and they didn't run a ton of – I mean, they had a bunch of stuff, but they had just played. But the second unit wasn't running that same stuff. They were just playing, you know. When you look at the Warriors, Steph isn't – I guess he's a different version of that. But they can still run and move the ball and do a lot of those same things. The Suns with Chris Paul, they can still hurt you in pick and roll when Chris Paul's on the bench. Or they could still run some of their movement sets to hurt you when Chris Paul's on the bench. So I think for Atlanta, it's just being able to mix in some more of that movement to where now, hey, we know we have this package of plays. We're going to go with this other stuff while the second unit's in to kind of get them going. Personnel-based it a little bit would be my thought.
Makes sense, makes sense. Some Hawks wisdom from Steve Jones Jr.
Is make sense a new fair enough?
No, it's not.
Dunkers, let me know. Does it make sense a new fair enough?
I can't acknowledge that you've made a sensical argument. Like, I don't know what you want from me. I feel like I can't win.
Oh, you just figured this out?
All right. This one's okay. This one's from Alex, who asks, I guess this first part is for me. Now that you are a bass guitar guy, what are the songs you are most excited to learn? Also, who should the Celtics target as a third star to put around Jalen and Jason, and what would it take to get that guy? Good luck building up calluses. Okay, I am not looking forward to building up calluses. For
Nicholas Duncan.
Oh no. Boo. Not gonna allow it.
Nakai Base Duncan.
Jesus. I guess for those who didn't see it on Twitter, I got a bass guitar today. Recording on Thursday night. So got a new bass guitar. I'm trying to teach myself bass. Song I'm trying to learn. I don't know. Like I'm a gospel guy. So really anything that my church sings, like if I could get that down, that'd be cool. I guess selfishly, I want to learn some Ty Trippett stuff because that man is a freaking mastermind musically. So if I could move my fingers quickly enough to hit any of those bass riffs in any of his songs, that would be dope. As for the Celtics, honestly, man, anyone that could put more pressure on the rim. Like I want someone that can make life a little bit easier for the Jays. So if that's a dynamic ball handler, a more dynamic ball handler than Dennis Schroeder, that would be dope. Domantas Sabonis would be fun. It's kind of a post hub. And the passing could get the Jays off ball a little bit more. The issue with getting a Sabonis would be like, what does Indiana want? I would imagine they would want probably Jaylen Brown in a Sabonis deal in Boston. I would imagine that's a non-starter for Boston. So like if you could toss your non-Jays stuff at Indiana, and I think Boston has their first round picks moving forward. So if you can find the right combination of stuff, then maybe there's your third star. You could have more of an inside out dynamic between those three guys. Steve, what do you think?
It's a very good question. So thank you for contributing, Alex. I got caught in a web on this one. Point guard, and I went player type more than anything. So I'm going to try and match the two for you because you had the names. Point guard doesn't do it for me as much. I go back to the Paul George Kawhi thing where it has to be the right type of person because they're going to get the on-ball reps they're going to get. And so do you necessarily want a guy who's going to have a bunch of on-ball reps as well? So for me, if it was going to be a guard, I would want it to be like a Patty Mills, Jalen Brunson-esque type player. So someone who can finish a play, someone who could start a play, can help you on ball, but doesn't necessarily need the ball.
Okay.
You know, so if they're able to make plays, drive, kick, now they can get another drive, that type of deal. Or they can start pick and roll, kick it to them. Now they're attacking a rotating defense potentially. Just those kind of things. That would probably be more of it for me. And it also helped make defenses pay if they send help. I would let Sabonis intrigues me just because I'm thinking of a big and what big would work best with them. My first thought was like an elite roller. Mm-hmm. Just so you can have someone that at least puts pressure on the weak side and maybe open some reads up. But then again, how much are you going to make teams not play drop against you? So I kind of went back and forth on that. Maybe like someone who can pop and go right into another handoff, just kind of like a connector.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought maybe like a shooting four would help. Maybe get some more floor spacing. I'm not sure. It's a tough deal because you don't necessarily want to get in the way of them, but you also don't want to not give them help. So I don't know. It's a tough one.
It's an interesting mix. Like, obviously, Jason Tatum is really freaking good, which, as much as I've questioned, like, hey, what's going on with Jason Tatum this year on this podcast? I feel like I've done that like 3 or 4 times this year. That man is cooking as of late. It's a lovely sight. But obviously, he's really good. Jaylen Brown's really good. It's interesting you brought the Kawhi Paul George thing. That wasn't where I thought you were going to go. Where I thought you were going with that was like the end of game, quote unquote, issue to where you can't really use those two in actions together because you just switch those actions and you're not really generating an advantage in that way.
Very true.
You can't use them together right now. And I guess that's where having that guard would help. Because in theory, you could use them as a screener, force a switch, and they could still make you pay. So I see where you're going there. The thing is, I feel like Tatum is tough one-on-one, so maybe you can survive. Maybe I'm leaning more towards the guard, the right type of guard. You could free them up, play the mismatch game, punish teams. Yeah, I think you got me.
Like guards, it's like I mentioned Sabonis because I think, I mean, the prompt was like third star. So like Sabonis works. But like ideally, you have like the vertical spacer in Rob Williams. You have the playmaking post hub in Al Horford. Like in theory, they kind of have both of what you need in the front court, but it feels like something. So like maybe I'm with you. Like maybe they do need like a more dynamic guard to really complement what the Jays provide, and I guess what they have in the front court as well. But like you mentioned Jalen Brunson and Patty Mills, like I don't think either of those guys are available. But if there's another guard like that, I wonder what that would cost Boston. Like that would probably cost them one of like, it'd probably cost them like a Rob Williams or a Marcus Smart or something to get that type of guy in there, depending on who it is. So I don't know. This is a really good question. You had some heaters.
Dunkers brought the heat today.
They did. All right, let's move to Jeremy, who asked, how close is Brandon Ingram to the 2019-20 versions of Devin Booker and Zach LaVine for the title of best young wing who needs better teammates?
I don't know if he's in that range. It's a good question, Jeremy. Those guys, their rise felt a little bit different than what Brandon Ingram's doing this year. And I don't know how much of that has to do with the Pelicans' record. Because I think Brandon Ingram's gotten better. I don't know how much we can tell right now. And I honestly think the teammate part makes it a little harder to analyze because I think we've both agreed or mentioned he's kind of evolving into like the Brandon Ingram we were waiting for. But how much of that is usage? How much of that is the team he's playing with? Is it changing how teams guard him? You know, because I like what he's done with some of the two-man game with Valanciunas. And I think he's shown some growth as far as being patient this season. You know, it feels like he's engaging the big a little bit more in the drop rather than, oh, there's space, I'm going to pull up. You know, it feels like he's taking that extra dribble, using that length, and then either finishing or dumping off. Or if he gets two on the ball, you'll see him take an extra dribble to drag him when Jonas pops and then hit him for the pop. Those are little things that I don't think he had done as consistently before. And I feel like the drives have a little bit more force to him this year. Like where he's really making an attempt to two hard dribbles, length, step, spin, finish, and use that advantage. But I feel like if you compare it to Booker and LaVine, it felt like they were just, you could feel they were making a leap. The scoring was different. And now defenses had to react and guard them differently, and they were punishing them in that way too. So I don't know if it's a fair apples to apples type deal.
Okay. I'm with you. Like, he does seem more patient. Like, I've enjoyed the passing improvements from him. He seems more, like, there is a little bit more manipulation there, and he also just generally seems a little bit more willing to make passes. I don't think, and the assist numbers are solid for him, but like, I don't even think they fully reflect the passing season he's had because of who he's had to play with, particularly early on in the year. Like, he's humming right now. I think he's averaging something like 27-6-6 over his last like 6 or 7 games. Like, he's been really freaking good. Like, I think I'm okay with putting him in the very least, like putting him in like the LaVine class. Or you could tell, like, he's like, Brandon Ingram should not be getting he's an empty calories, like, conversation around him. Like, I think it's very clear that he's a very good offensive player the playmaking has improved. You know what he does as a scorer. As you mentioned, drives are coming with a little bit more verve. He can get to his pull-up whenever he wants to. Like, he's showing more patience this year, but, like, if all else fails, he can always take a high ball screen, snake it, and then get into that pull-up. And there's just not much you can do with him with that kind of length and that kind of release point. And so, like, it feels like the game has slowed down for him. So I would like to see him, again, going back to the top of the show, like, I would like to see Zion with him, with this version of him. And I want to see what Brandon Ingram looks like playing off of that type of rim gravity. Because if this is what Brandon Ingram is doing now, pretty much as the number one, without the full assortment beside him right now, like, if he's playing off of Zion rim pressure and he gets to attack more bent defenses with the improved passing vision, with the more aggressive drives, I feel like there's a little bit more there for him. Like, there's probably another, I want to say leap, that might be too aggressive, but, like, there's another step for him to take if he's able to play off someone like that.
Now, you bring up an interesting point. I think I would agree. And I think that's where I'm missing, just wanting to see him with the complete set and him being able to attack bent defenses, him not having to do as much Brandon Ingram stuff. That would probably give me a better gauge. But the consistency that he's brought, you know, that was a question mark before, and I feel like he's brought it when he's played. Now, the question I would have, and it's probably not a fair one, could he do this with Zion in the lineup? Would we see the same growth and consistency because his reps might be different? Would he get used in the same way? And those are questions we just don't have the answer to. I'm still going to ask him to, though.
And I feel that, like, I think that would be the concern, if that's the word I want to use. Like, would it turn into, like, ideally they just flow off of each other, but there does run the risk of it just being a my turn, your turn type situation, in which you add the talent but the offense as a whole becomes a little bit more stagnant because they're trying to work Zion in, they're still trying to build chemistry together because, you know, they've been together what, 2-3 years now, but, like, they haven't got to play a ton together because both guys have had to deal with injuries. So, like, I wonder what that adjustment period is going to be like. But, I mean, if VI is able to stay, you know, stay aggressive, stay decisive, that's the word I was looking for. If he's able to stay decisive, like, you can see the fit. Like, I think the skill sets are contrasting enough to where it can mesh together. But again, like, we just have to see it.
I'm with it. That was a good question.
Very good. Very good. We got some Pelicans talk on the podcast. We love that. All right. Next one comes from Warren. Says, I've heard some of the Jokic MVP talks. While valid, his team is 500. Should we change the criteria of MVP voting?
Jokic-related content. I love it. And I'm going to take this left here shortly, but I'm going to answer the question.
Okay.
So let's go full transparency here. All right. Jokic has been solidly in my top four all season. So my four, in whatever order, depending on the day or the week, has been Stephen Curry, Kevin Durant, Giannis, and Nikola Jokic. Those have been the four. Now, for me personally, I have a lot of fun trying to figure out 5 through 8. Not sure why. Doesn't really matter. But that's a fun discussion for me. But those are the top four, clearly. And Jokic has been in there. And another full transparency type deal. When it comes to MVP talk, and I'll snitch on myself, growing up, I used to be a sucker for the word valuable. And so I would make arguments to my dad all the time that Allen Iverson should be the MVP because have you seen the rest of the Sixers? And quick apology to Eric Snow. I used to kill you when I was little. Do you want better? Orlando T-Mac thought he should have been the MVP.
You are talking my language.
Well, no, I had hot takes when I was young.
Back in the day
before. Anyways, no jokes. So the Nuggets record doesn't really make me view Jokic poorly. If anything, for me, I probably flip it because I don't think they'd be there in this position without him. I do understand how and why someone would point to that as a negative. I mean, it's an easy layup. How can you be the best player in the league on a 500 team? I get it. Doesn't jive with some folks. But for me, I don't know if we have to change the criteria, because when this thing is done right, the conversations are fun. You know, when we had our awards episodes, it was fun. It's legitimately fun to have four players playing at the peak in all sorts of different ways. You know, think about how LeBron is barely in the conversation. That's different, right? And yep. For me, this conversation, it's a credit to how good Jokic has been. And, you know, narratives are going to narrative, but it does feel like good basketball is being appreciated more. Now, with Jokic, it's a different deal. Some people just don't see it. We've talked about it before. I don't know if some people just don't respect some of his buckets. I don't know how you do at this point, because he's done it for a few years now. Like, I got maybe year one, but it's kind of his thing. So, like, you just got to deal with that. But I mean, there's always going to be a flaw with the MVP because it's a regular season award and there's so much of an ebb and flow to it. And one injury can change the whole landscape of it. I mean, you go back to last year, what LeBron had it running away, it felt like, and then Embiid had it running away, it felt like. And then you look up and neither of them are around. And oh yeah, Jokic is still great. Yep, he's the guy. He did it for the longest time. So I don't know that you need to change the criteria. I just think there needs to be more open and honest conversations and more actual talk about the basketball players. If you told me today to pick one of those top four, I'd have a hard time. They all have extremely valid cases. And so when you have players that have equally good cases, you end up using records to maybe tie break or stretches to maybe tie break. So I'm interested to hear what you have to say.
I guess to first answer the question about change the criteria, like, I don't think we have a criteria, which I think is intentional for the league's part. Like, I think they, you know, they leave valuable up for interpretation for the voters for this very reason, for this discussion, because people view the game differently. They evaluate players differently. They interpret value differently. And so that's how we have something like this. For me, like, I do think MVP is a combination of, you know, your number slash impact and also winning. And so I'm not upset with anyone that does not have Jokic as the MVP. So I'll start there. I don't know if I have Jokic as my number one guy right now. What I don't like about the Jokic discussion in particular is, like, it just feels like this is an extension of last year to where, like, what he does is kind of being dismissed or not fully understood. And that's where I have the issue, because it's like, it just feels like people struggle with considering Jokic as an MVP type talent. And, like, that shouldn't be a question at all. If he's the actual MVP this season, sure, we can debate about that, because, again, like, what Steph Curry and Golden State are doing is incredible. What Kevin Durant is doing is freaking incredible. And, like, both of those guys are at the top of their conference with what they're doing. And what Giannis is doing on both ends is incredible. Now, he's in COVID protocol, so, like, that's probably going to knock him down a peg. Like, Giannis is probably number four by default at this point, despite the fact that he's been, again, like, he's been incredible. I made the tweet yesterday where I was like, I think Jokic and Giannis have probably been the two best players in basketball this season. But because, you know, due part to the record and, like, missed games, like, Steph and KD are probably one and two in some order. And that's fine. Like, these are four very valid choices for MVP. And, like, this is December. So, like, there's so much that can and probably will change by the time this is over with. But I do wish, like, we could just acknowledge. I just want Jokic to get a little bit more respect than he does. And it's an odd thing to say about someone who won MVP last year. But, like, even then, like, it felt like a reluctant MVP from the vibe that I got from reading my timeline to listening to others make cases up against him and stuff. Like, it's just a weird dynamic with Jokic, and I don't know why.
I mean, Jokic did get 91 first place votes. I'm just saying.
He did, but like, I don't know. Like, it could just be me being in my social media box. Like, that's very much.
Get out of your bubble. Let's have a conversation about it. Because I always like to think about, what are other people thinking when they say things? And I feel like sometimes when we have these basketball conversations or thoughts, a statement that says one thing gets funneled and taps into something that a person feels. So if you say something that maybe not, you may not even be saying Jokic is bad, but you just don't see that he's the best player better than X, Y, or Z, now that triggers something and it goes on and on and on. So I think about maybe someone who just maybe hasn't seen Jokic as much. And then you compare him to maybe these other top three players. And this isn't necessarily my opinion. I'm just spitballing here. As great as he is, it's probably a lot easier for the other three to pop to people, right? Unfortunately, it's easier to see the brilliance of Steph Curry or Kevin Durant or the raw athleticism and power of Giannis. But if I asked person X, what does Jokic do well? I don't know if they'd be able to tell me. What do we do with that?
I mean, my real answer is to yell at them to do better. But, like, I don't. No, in all seriousness, like, I'm not sure how to go about that. Because, I mean, for me, it seems obvious when you watch him. And, like, I don't want to come off, like, condescending in any way. So my apology if it does come off that way. It's not my intention. But, like, you watch Jokic and, like, he runs the offense. He scores in all three levels. So, like, I guess for me, it's just, like, why do we marvel over Kevin Durant knocking down pull-ups over the outstretched arm to defenders that can't reach a shot? And don't understand, you know, and then it's just nothing when Jokic is sprinkling in post fadeaways over the outstretched arms of people. Like, what is the difference between the two?
There's a grace. I've sat with people and they've been like, that's lucky. I'm like, no, that's kind of a shot. there's people who just feel like some of his finishes and the step back one-legged, it's just maybe luck, which isn't fair. And again, I'm just being contrarian person right now. So it's one of those things where I get what you're saying, but you think about maybe someone you're interacting with who maybe didn't see a lot of Nuggets, right? And they're only going off, this man's the MVP, and I'm watching this playoff series against Phoenix. Fair or unfair, that might be their first exposure to him. So now they're going off that impression.
Well, one, I mean, that series shouldn't be in any way reflective of, like, the regular season, since it's a regular season award, first and foremost.
No. So, I mean, like, that's just their impression of him.
I get what you're saying. I'm just saying, like, but I guess that's... I guess that's where my question comes in, is like, how do we collectively go about shifting that? But obviously, you can't watch games for other people. But, like, that's also kind of the annoying thing about arguing about Jokic online, at least for me. Because for me, I'm just like, if you watch him, you'll see how good he is. And then if it is someone that hasn't watched him for whatever reason, like if you're in Denver, like, it's kind of a struggle to watch games, period, just because of the whole TV deal or whatever. But, like, if you're not a Denver fan, you're not watching Jokic. Then, you know, you bring up some of the numbers that Jokic puts up, the per game stuff or the advanced stuff. And then it turns into, oh, if you got to bring up these advanced numbers, then he obviously isn't that good. You should be able to tell by your eye test. And it's just like, okay, if you're not watching them and you also don't accept the numbers that further exemplify what you would see if you watched them, what else is there to do in that situation?
Well, now you wonder, does Jokic become a victim of a larger argument that he has nothing to do with?
Absolutely, yes.
So yes. Now, instead of being able to enjoy Jokic or hear anything about it, he represents something that you maybe not agree with. So now, per usual, things get convoluted and complicated, and you're arguing over something that you're really not arguing about.
Correct. And it's annoying and infuriating and exhausting.
Oh, but that's why I just like showing Jokic clips whenever he does something crazy, because film doesn't lie. I do a good job of watching games for people.
That you do. This is why you are the man, the myth, the legend.
I'm none of those things. I'm just a guy.
All right. We're not doing fake modesty on this podcast. All right.
So what was your beef with the players not saying Jokic was the best? Yeah, I'm going here since we're on the topic. We're here. The hashtag is big mad folks. We are a bike.
Just like that poll should be all the reason why the NBA fixes lead pass. There's no reason for Jokic and Embiid to be tied in votes. And I think they both got what? Two votes each for the best player title. Jokic got one more vote than Zion Williamson. And he won MVP last year. And I just don't understand. And like this ain't, you know, random Twitter user. These are former players. You always hear, like, no one knows the game better than the people that played it. Respect your elders, respect the pros, respect the former players, you know. And then it's like Zion Williamson gets a vote for best player in the league. That doesn't compute for me.
Why not?
Because it's just wrong. But like,
this is where it gets interesting. And this is the piece that's missing for what I feel it's missing these days. I don't know if the player perspective is truly understood. And I don't know if the angle of what players and who players respect has ever truly been grasped. How much did LeBron James love playing with Sasha Pavlovich?
You said what now?
How much did LeBron James love playing with Sasha Pavlovich? A whole bunch, right?
Mm-hmm.
No one is sitting here with a high opinion of Sasha. No disrespect. But LeBron had one.
Mm-hmm.
Rudy Gobert, considered one of the best defensive players, right? Mm-hmm. If not the best. Look at how players try and go at him and treat him and talk about him and respect him. Both of these things can exist at the same time. But instead of them existing, they feel like they're opposed. And now it becomes this weird yin-yang where everyone searches for ex-NBA opinions, but then also makes fun of ex-NBA opinions. And it's like, well, you got to understand, there's a give and take here. There's a reason why a lot of players aren't coaches. Doesn't mean they're not brilliant. Doesn't mean they don't know the game. Sometimes it's hard for you to take what you know and tell it to other people and get them to understand it. It's tough. So when I looked at it, I was like, a bunch of players from the 70s and 80s where the game was 1-2 dribble pull up. Let me go get a bucket. They seem to have respect for Kevin Durant. I get it. Oh, they embrace the grace of LeBron James and the power and how he's been able to hold on. I get it. The shocker to me was Giannis being third. That man would have made that list 2 years ago. But it evolves. So for me, with Jokic and that, it's unfortunately going to take a little bit more time than some would anticipate. But his brilliance will and should be seen, because the people who have to guard him never say anything about him.
I just wish the process moved a little bit more quickly, I guess is where I'm at.
I feel like I need to make more Nikola joke.
All right, that's enough. That's enough out of you.
too much wisdom from your boy tonight.
You drop all that wisdom and then you come with that. It's just the duality of man. This is,
yeah, balance. If I'm hurting you in the paint, I got to go ahead and take a pull up every now and then.
I see. Just mix it up. All right. The next one's going to come from Dallin. I hope I'm saying that right. You can virtually beat me up if I didn't.
Dylon.
It's funny. We have a question from a Dylan coming up too. But anyway, mainly thoughts on the long-term prospects of the two young sons' wings. I love both, but I feel like Cam Johnson sometimes is viewed as the off-ball shooter and Mikal Bridges as the future secondary creator if Chris Paul ever slows down. But I feel like it should be the reverse. Mikal is elite in his role, but he has a slower release and doesn't seem to be as aggressive or explosive with the ball in his hands. Cam Johnson has some crazy dunks. He mentions one over JaVale McGee, Jared Allen over PJ Tucker in the finals last year, and looks more comfy in the half court. So, Steve, where are you at on Mikal Bridges and Cam Johnson as creators?
I was totally anticipating a dribble handoff this one and go sit at the dunker spot, but I'm here. I think that it's about evolution for both of them to me. I think both of them are probably better fit to just be two-way guys who add a lot of value to your team on both ends of the floor rather than sticking them in a box. For me, with Cam Johnson, I noticed his growth once he was more consistent defensively. And then on the offensive end, I feel like he can develop into a guy you can run off screens and maybe get him some on-ball reps that way. Maybe he develops into a handoff type guy, get some staggers going. I don't know how much pick and roll you want to get him in, but you hope that maybe the shooting can make defenses pay if they're backed up, and you're hoping that handle can grow to where now, hey, I can see where the next play is. I can make a pass. I can throw a lob, do the little things there to where now I'm involved in action and making plays by not just scoring. Obviously, the shooting is going to bring him to the table. But to me, it's what are you going to do when that closeout's there? Can you beat those closeouts consistently? And that's probably the question I have with both of them right now. You know, as far as Bridges goes, I think the biggest thing that goes under the radar for him offensively is his cutting. Like, his ability to cut is really underrated. He just has a great knack of knowing when and where to flash, how to hurt teams that way when he's on the weak side, when to read. But my question with him now becomes not necessarily what can he do with the on-ball reps, but what's his in-between game look like? So I think we can agree he's got some shooting chops, pretty good in transition. He's got some cutting. But let's say he catches that defender's there. What's that look like? Is he going to be just a driving kick guy? If he doesn't get by you, can he pull up, spin, finish, any of those things? Is that his next evolution to maybe throwing a little bit more consistency offensively? Because for me, I like when he's aggressive offensively and not just shooting threes, but just has the mindset to attack. But too often it feels like sometimes he'll kind of fade in the background a little bit and you get those three or four shot nights. So I'm high on both of them. I think those are probably the next steps for me.
Okay. So I would say, like, it's funny that this question came in today because we were actually in a group chat. I was in. We was actually talking a little bit about Mikal Bridges and some of his limitations with the ball. And, like, I think with Mikal versus Cam in particular, like, I think I think Mikal has a little bit more shake. Like he's shown a little bit more, craft, a little bit more, you know, changing speeds when he's able to run some pick and roll actions. Like we talked about on the Suns episode, like the Suns have experimented using him kind of in the Devin Booker role in some of their pick and roll sets. So they give him that usage. I think with both guys off the ball, I think Cam is more decisive. And I think that's where I can see where Dallin is coming from, where it's just like, if you need someone to handle a little bit more usage or to really be that connective tissue, like, why doesn't Cam get more attention in that regard? Because, you know, obviously he can shoot, but also he doesn't hold it. Mikal seems to think a little bit and then slither and go, which can work with some of those secondary ball screens. Again, like the pull-up jumper has improved for him. He has the touch, the high release, and that's what intrigues. Like, it's honestly, like we talked about this a little bit with the Hawks a few episodes ago, like with DeAndre Hunter, to where like the increase in on-ball reps was interesting with him, but there was also a little bit of a lack of flow in the offense when he got those reps because of how methodical he was. And so for Mikal, I think more than anything, that's probably his next step. Because we know he can shoot. We know he can finish. Like when he just doesn't have the ball in his hands, we know he's a smart cutter, an aggressive cutter. I think when he has the ball in his hands, like I think it comes down to him just going and maintaining the advantage in that regard. Because right now it feels like there's a little bit of a pause for him right now. And I think once the game slows down a little bit more for him, he may be able to just take off a little bit more often than he does right now.
I think when he makes quicker decisions, he usually gets better results.
Yeah.
And he has the ability. I mean, he's a smart basketball player. It's not he can't make reads, but it feels like when he makes those quick decisions, you know, I cut, hand off, two dribbles, hit a pocket pass for Ayton. Now he's able to operate and be more of a threat than I caught it. My man's here. I only have one thing to do, you know? So I think I'd be with you there as far as if he can process quicker and just let it go a little bit and not maybe be as cerebral sometimes, he'll probably put himself in a better position. He's probably one of those guys you probably like to see. I don't want to say the unleashed confidence type of deal, but it would be fun to see him just go sometimes, just catch and go. But he's a winning basketball player, so he makes the right play.
He's good. And obviously, just zooming out, like this is a really good problem for Phoenix to have. Like, hey, you talk about this young wing can break out. Why not this young wing? Like, if that's the question that you're asking, you're in a pretty good spot in terms of your wing depth. And they're both young, so we shall see. This one comes from Dylan, who says, with James Harden's relative struggles combined with the shockingly mediocre to poor spacing, what do you think would make a greater positive difference for the Nets? A non-Joe Harris floor spacing wing or a legitimate secondary creator? Oftentimes, the offensive creation burden on KD and Harden feels like it's way too high, but at the same time, the spacing options have been very limited. Is there anything or anyone you'd like to see them experiment with more to possibly help in either area before the trade deadline approaches?
Dylan, good question. Thank you for contributing. You did not mention the Nets' shockingly better defense in your question, but that's okay. We'll let that slide. Interesting question. A non-Joe Harris floor spacing wing or a legitimate secondary creator? I had a little bit of a problem with this. So we're going with the idea that Redacted is not going to the free throw line this year, right?
Yeah, I think we can rule out Redacted.
Okay. No free throw shots for him. I would probably say for this Brooklyn group, I would lean more towards a non-Joe Harris floor spacing wing. In theory, if you're going with a secondary creator, it would probably have to be someone who can hit shots while spaced and drive closeouts or finish plays, because KD and James Harden's on-ball reps are going to be what they are. That's, you know, the ground beef and the hamburger, so to speak. And you kind of already have a version of that in Patty Mills. So I don't know who you would add on top off the top of my head. Not that it wouldn't help, because now you can slide Mills to the bench, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, there is value in spacing Harden and KD, but to me, it doesn't hit the same if the defense isn't responding to that ball handler in the same way. So for me, if you get another spacer, you can get back to a few more of those actions where you really put pressure on defenses. And now you add more value to KD and Harden's reps, and you make those a little bit easier at times. So that's probably where I would lean toward it, because you have defenders. You have a whole room of bigs, and the on-ball reps are going to be what they are. So I'd probably like to see a wing. You get a 3-and-D guy, be able to mix them in. Now you can have more lineup versatility. That's where I landed on that one.
Okay. How about we just make everybody upset? How about you just get a Joe Harris, Caris LeVert trade? Let's just do that. Let Caris create. There's your secondary creator. Yeah. Rick Carlisle gets the souped up Doug McDermott replacement when Joe Harris is healthy again. Everybody's happy except the fan bases. But in all seriousness, I think I land with you. Like, I think the non-Joe Harris floor space and wing probably makes the most sense, because I think they have – it's felt like, I think from their draft class, honestly, I think they have both options that they could experiment with to go into the second part of the question. Like, I think Cam Thomas can soak up some of those creation reps. You let him grow in that. Like, obviously, he's very confident. Like, he's taking contested shots with KD on the floor. So, like, I think he can feel some of that. And as far as the non-Harris floor space and wing, like, Kessler Edwards has given them some good minutes as of late. And so...
you're going to ride the Claxton and Kessler Edwards train?
What is the problem? Matter of fact, we talked about this during the offseason. I like Brooklyn's draft. This is not a new take for me. But anyway, like, they have young talent worth getting reps. Like, it stinks that it's taken this for them to get the reps that they're getting as of late. Like, everyone's missing. But I do think this is kind of a silver lining deal where it's like, okay, these are young players with archetypes that we kind of need filled. And if they can provide value now and kind of accelerate the curve a little bit, we may have something moving forward. So I think in terms of experimentation, like, I think you just continue to play those young guys even as you get a little bit healthier. I don't think you need to make a major trade unless something obvious pops up on the trade market. You know, to clarify, like, no, I don't think they should trade for Caris LeVert. I don't think that's part of the ministry. But no, I think giving Edwards, giving Cam Thomas more minutes, I think that's some low-hanging fruit for them to get what they need.
Nah, I mean, you got to credit the Nets system. They do find talent. They develop talent. I think it's gone under the radar because of the stars. I think you're sleeping on what may be the Nets' best rookie, David Duke Jr.
Okay. You think he's their best rookie?
Kid can play, man.
Yes, but is he better than... yeah, okay. It's fine. That's not worth disagreeing about right now.
Nah, get it out, man. Get it out.
It's fine. It's fine.
You disagree?
We shall see. We'll see as the sample rises. It's fine.
I think he's a very complete basketball player.
He's solid. I want to see him shoot confidently. But no, he's solid. He's solid. No major complaints.
Hey, what do I know about basketball, right?
Hey, man. You know, you will forget more basketball than I'll know, in all seriousness. So, like, it's fine.
And all of you, it's fine. Don't worry about it.
There we go. All right. This one comes from Luis, who asks, how high are you guys on Jalen Brunson? I'm really impressed with how good he's playing this season. This guy is freaking smart and has a lot of moves in his bag. Do you think that he can take on a major role on a team like the Celtics or even the Sixers?
I love what Jalen Brunson's done this year. I love his juice and transition. Love how he forces his way onto the court. Way he can get in the paint, change speeds. Talk about the bag, hesitation, crossover, spin. Kick if you need to. I love that Jason Kidd is giving him post-up ISOs.
Of course he is.
it's just on brand.
Of course he is.
I actually would like him for both of those teams, to be honest, because he's good on the ball, but again, he doesn't really need it. What he does can translate to playing off the ball. If it gets skipped to him or it's late clock, he can finish those plays. He can create plays. So I would probably, if I had to choose between them, I would probably like to see him on the Celtics more than the Sixers. And the Sixers, you have Maxey, who gives you a version of that. You also have Seth Curry. So it's going to be, I mean, I don't know if you want to play, how many of those you want to play together.
Yeah, but, I don't know.
So I'd probably lean towards Celtics there. I think he'd be a good fit there.
Okay. I am with you. Like, I do think the Celtics would be the better fit there. I think in general, like, yes, he can handle a larger role. Like, the pick and roll chops are there. You said he can get downhill. Like, the Jalen Brunson spin and the Jalen Brunson half spin. He's just nifty, man. This is a reason. There's a reason why he won National Player of the Year in college. Like, he's a bona fide scorer. You almost wouldn't notice it with some of the playmaking chops that he does have. So, like, I'm glad that he's gotten a little bit more offensive responsibility this year. I think that's been a benefit of Jason Kidd's emphasis to spread the wealth a little bit more this year, or at least attempt to, because, like, Luka's touches are still up this year, which is hilarious.
But, how much wealth is there to spread?
I mean, let's be nice. You're not wrong. You don't have to say it. but no, I'm glad that Brunson is getting a little bit more of the creation burden. He's really freaking good. So we are fans of Jalen Brunson here at the Dunker Spot. Let's go to Jade, who asks, with how the Heat have been playing since Jimmy Butler and Bam Adebayo have been out around 500 basketball, does that change how you look at them as far as their contending status? If I recall, I think the Kaiser was a little more down on them in the recent episodes, but Steve still had the guts. Also, where are we at with the Gabe Vincent MVP chatter?
Gabe Vincent had himself a night in Philadelphia. This man was throwing one-hand passes, making every three. Goodness gracious. As far as answering the question, thank you, Jade. I'm not particularly changing my outlook on Miami. If there is one team in this league that is going to gain 10 to 15 points in strength and awareness and winning when injuries hits, it's the Miami Heat. I think every year Spo somehow finds a way to get them through a stretch that it looks like, hey, they're probably not going to get through this stretch. I mean, you got Martin playing like this, Vincent playing like this, Strus has had his days, Casey got Paula at the five, P.J. Tucker running around trying to win everything. P.J. Tucker's going to win them at least five more games. Dwayne Dedmon making hustle plays. Dwayne Dedmon low-key won them that game. I'm going to give him his credit.
He did.
Man was active in pick and roll, took a big charge, tapped the rebound out to Gabe Vincent. So salute to Dwayne Dedmon. But Spo's magic and the effort and the am I supposed to say the word? I'm going to do the thing. The culture.
Ah, there it is.
Yeah. Guts. I don't necessarily put them backwards. Now, the issue I do have with this stretch, it's going to make their path harder, which they don't necessarily need. So Miami probably needed to be in that 1-2 range, maybe 3. But if they have to be in a situation where they might have to go through Brooklyn and Milwaukee, it's not necessarily what you want to do. So that's probably where the only thing shifts. But I mean, if nothing else, this stretch is going to make you hold your defense, which you was already good, but now you're having to maintain it with less personnel. And then offensively, you've seen them have to get back at least to a little bit more movement. It's not quite the dribble handoff you to death type stuff, but more movement. So hopefully once you get your players back, you get healthy, you have a mix of your defense, you have more movement offensively. Now you can mix back in with the one-on-one, the ISOs, the mismatch hunting, and it brings a nice meal to the table. And Gabe Vincent, MVP chatter, non-existent. Sorry.
Wow. There went the guts. I see. I have been pleasantly surprised and impressed with this recent Heat stretch. I think I mentioned this on a prior episode. Like, I was in Miami for Heat Bucks. I was talking with some media pals before that game, and it's like, well, I came here expecting a really good one, but none of Miami stars are playing. The Bucks have virtually their full assortment. Like, this is probably not going to be a fun game. And so then we get the Caleb Martin game. It's just like, okay, well, all right, cool. The Caleb Martin game, we got the crazy KZ Apollo block and Max Strus lighting it up in the fourth quarter. They've gotten a little bit from everyone during this stretch, which I think is a positive. I think heading into the year, one of the question marks, if not outright concerned about this Heat team, was like, what does their depth actually look like beyond the starting lineup? And so the fact that you've gotten this kind of production from Caleb Martin on a two-way contract, and he's been out the last couple of games, but the fact that you've gotten this from him, Gabe Vincent has found himself. Max Strus, again, he's filled in some gaps. KZ Apollo showing signs of life on the defensive end at the very least. But wait, what is the face for?
On the defensive end? All right, man. I saw this man mess up a switch. It's all right, though.
Okay. Well, there you have it. He messed up a switch. He's done for, folks. We've done it. But
wait till Markieff comes back.
Is he going to come back? Because, again, I ask, are we sure that that man has a neck? He has not played since the Jokic incident. Like, this has got to be, 20-something games at this point? We're getting up there. Anyway, like, the depth has stepped up, which is a positive. You know, if they can maintain their momentum there as the squad gets healthier, then this Heat team is going to look a little bit scarier. I think from like a scheme perspective, like, I've liked what I've seen from them defensively. They were a good defense when they were healthy, very switch heavy, which was a little bit of a surprise. I figured they would go to more drop this year since they added Kyle Lowry. But maintain switch heavy. Everyone goes down, and now we're seeing some drop with Dwayne Dedmon. We're seeing them send two to the ball. In the game against Philadelphia, they opened the game up in zone. And so it's nice to, not that it's a surprise, but it is nice to see that Eric Spoelstra has these different counters in the bag. He can mix up coverages when necessary. And so I probably feel a little bit better about Miami just because their depth, you know, some of those depth pieces that we had questions about heading into the year have outperformed expectations.
I mean, it's the same thing we talked about with Milwaukee earlier in the year. These reps are going to be important down the line. And you see Miami having that zone in their back pocket they didn't have to use. Well, now they can use it. And now, you know, you see them bringing the traps back. So you see Spo going into the back of his office, dusting off the box and pulling everything he can out of it. So that's going to be fun to watch.
Just the Spo's the best coach in the league, man. He's just a different breed altogether.
Spo's criminally underrated.
Yes.
He does not get his due for consistently getting the best out of his guys from top to bottom, too.
Mm-hmm. He deserves more love. All right. We will close this out with a series of better than questions from Carlo. Steve, better passer, Damian Lillard or Darius Garland?
This is a really good question, Carlo. And I have to give the nod to Darius Garland right now.
It's Garland. It's fine.
Some of those bounce passes to Jared Allen. Ooh.
The bounce passes, the offhand shovels, the lobs, the cross court lately. He's got it all in the bag, man. He's incredibly fun.
He's moved into the manipulating defenses category.
We're here. All right. Better shot maker, Devin Booker or DeMar DeRozan?
Shooter is Booker, but DeMar for shot maker. This man can get to a spot at any time, does so, and it doesn't matter who's on him, what you're doing defensively. He gets to his spot, he rises up. He's got a shot every time, so DeMar for me.
Okay. I'm going to give it a slight edge to Booker. I do give him the boost because of the shooting, but you can't go wrong with either. DeMar has been incredible. Hopefully he gets better soon. Better perimeter defender, Marcus Smart or Matisse Thybulle?
Marcus Smart, combination of the on-ball, off-ball, I still give him the edge. Matisse is coming, but Smart for me.
Okay. Also going to give the edge to Smart. Just a little bit more discipline to me. Better screen navigator. Stronger. Like, I just worry about Smart a little bit less. Though Tybalt is obviously very good. Better shooter. Patty Mills or Duncan Robinson?
Yikes. Duncan. I didn't like it.
I can feel the disgust. I mean, this season, Patty's been a better shooter. It's an interesting question because I think he does more with the ball than Duncan does. But, like, just the level of contest for Duncan. Like, I guess if I was to split it up, like, I think Duncan's the better shooter and Patty's probably better at generating a look for himself. On and off the ball.
What I was going to give Patty the edge is he can knock down spot ups, but also hurts you just pull ups off the dribble. But then again, the degree of difficulty that Duncan Robinson has on some of his handoff wise and just contests fire away made it tough. But I gave Duncan the lean, although Patty Mills is shooting the heck out of the ball right now.
That he is. And the last one, better pick and roll navigator, Luka Doncic or James Harden?
Wow, that's a good question. I left this one blank on my notes.
You left it blank. Oh, man.
James Harden.
Okay. This is a good one because it feels like obviously the rim pressure is down for Harden this year, which makes it a little bit more difficult for him. But also Luka hasn't gotten to the rim a ton this year either, or at least compared to years past. A little bit bigger.
Oh, wait, this was offense? I thought it was defense.
Oh, no. Well, I mean, I guess the question was just better pick and roll navigator, so they didn't clarify which side of the ball it was.
Oh, if it's offense, then James Harden. No disrespect to Luka. Great talent, but no.
Oh, okay. It's tight, man. It's tight. They're both upper echelon, to say the least. I don't know. Like, yeah. I don't know. Like, this is both my favorite and least favorite of these five. Like, I'll probably lean. He hasn't had the floater going either, though. I'll probably lean Luka. I think he can get to the rim a little bit easier than Harden can right now. And there's more of a. I trust him more as a finisher, more as an intermediate scorer right now, in addition to being able to make every pass in the book. I'll give the slightest of edges to Luka. I don't feel great about it.
All right. Before we cap this off, I got a couple questions for you.
Okay.
Chris Paul, is there an MVP candidacy here?
I think there's a four and then there's a gap.
And then Chris Paul?
I'm fine with putting Chris Paul five.
Okay. So you're keeping that Steve Nash MVP energy for CP3.
Come on.
Well done. Any coincidence that you talked about the Memphis Grizzlies and then another person with a beard also talked about the Memphis Grizzlies having culture?
You can't keep getting away with it.
No, you can't keep getting away with it.
What do you mean? We're not sharing show notes. Like, I don't know.
Did the Lakers say forget analytics and advanced stats and went with the eye test when they signed Isaiah Thomas?
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the. Oh my God, that annoyed me to no end, man. Like, what are we talking about? What are we talking? Like, I just. it's not even like limited to Isaiah Thomas. When people make this argument, it's just like, why? Defense is never accounted for in this. Never. It is never accounted for in any of this. It's like, you don't need a calculator to see someone die on the screen. Like, I don't get why that's the straw man that's brought up. When I'm not getting big mad at the end of an episode. Did you have any other questions?
Nope. It was a success. The hashtag is big mad votes. I feel great about what I just accomplished right here.
Yeah,
I bet. See, the key is defensively, you want to mix your coverages. So you show the drop early. As the game progresses, then you hit them with the trap. And now, you know, you're not expecting it. Might get a turnover. You're good to go.
Disgusting behavior. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you have not already, please subscribe. Also, leave us a review. Give us 5 stars. We're on Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us. You can find me on Twitter at NikaiasNBA. You can find Steve and his awesome game threads on Twitter at SteveJones20. And with that, we will catch y'all next week.
Trae Young's really good at basketball.